This is the Inland Journal from Spokane Public Radio. I'm Doug Nadvornik. This week, a silicon smelter to be built just south of Newport, Washington, was thrust back into the news. The project was proposed more than a year ago by a Canadian company originally known as High Test Sands, but which now goes by the name PacWest Silicon. People in the greater Newport area, that includes North Idaho, have been discussing it ever since. The Washington Department of Commerce gave the company a $300,000 grant. The process by which the local government sold land to the company for the smelter has been questioned. And now the environmental review process has begun. This week, the State Department of Ecology is holding three public meetings designed to help it determine which issues it should feature in the final document it will write about the smelter. At the first two meetings, Tuesday night in Spokane, Wednesday night in Newport, residents of eastern Washington and northern Idaho had a chance to voice their opinions, and opponents took full advantage. Several questioned the legitimacy of the state review process. It's too early, they say. PacWest has not submitted detailed plans for its project, only a few pages of generalized information, a point made by Boise attorney Norm Semenko. He was hired by opponents to represent their interests.
How do we comment on a proposal that is incomplete, inaccurate, and in some regards illegal? We cannot provide comprehensive or complete comments. I totally agree with what you said last night, that SEPA needs to be factual, comprehensive, and fair. We don't see how it can be comprehensive or fair or complete factual if we don't have the applications in front of us.
SEPA is Washington's State Environmental Policy Act. It is the law that governs environmental reviews. The Ecology Department wasn't the only target. PacWest and its motives were questioned by Sister Leslie Lund of the Carmelite Sisters of Mary in Newport.
I don't understand how the governor had the right to subsidize this project right from the beginning. I don't understand why this company, that's a Canadian company, would be getting deals on electricity and on taxes, on the water, and the price of the land. It seems unjust.
And several North Idaho residents argued it's also unjust that they have no right to question a project that could inundate them with pollution. State Representative Heather Scott says the project will also have an effect on Idaho, and therefore the environmental review should be conducted not in accordance with Washington law, but with federal law.
You put a nice diagram up there, and you ask, what should we study? What should we study? Health, climate. How about a box called Idaho? And the Idaho citizens, and how this is going to impact Idaho citizens.
Others say it's not a matter of if the smelter will degrade the pristine environment of the region, but when. Lorraine Parlange is a lawyer from Airway Heights. Her family owns land near Horseshoe Lake. She says she worries that the toxins coming from the smelter stacks will exacerbate her daughter's fragile medical condition. She asked about reparations.
What is this company going to do to make this community whole? What are they going to do for their health and safety? I would say that during your environmental impact study, you must evaluate the regulatory noncompliance that's been demonstrated so far from this company. Based on high test past actions, their noncompliance, there is a very good chance that they will continue to not be compliant with whatever's in place.
Christy Hewling, who owns a garden business in Bonner County, said she supports the smelter, but admits she has some concern, too. It would be right in my backyard, she said. On Tuesday in Spokane, a representative of a Spokane union that represents construction workers says he likes the wages and health benefits that would come to his members who would help build the facility. But the voices of other supporters at these two hearings were few. Nancy Thompson, a member of the Newport City Council, says she is trying to keep an open mind about the project.
I just hope that we can keep the conversation civil between, the two different opinions.
Outside the high school before the Newport meeting, three men proudly displayed a large yard sign for the organization that supports the smelter. A few people say the project has them making plans to leave the area. They included a man who called himself Sean.
It's led me to try and sell my private properties and therefore my business to relocate out of Pend Oreille County. This has proved to be impossible. because no one is buying in the Newport area because of the wait-and-see attitude.
The Department of Ecology will hold one more public meeting tonight at 6 at the Event Center in Priest River, Idaho. The agency will accept public comments in writing, online, and in other forms until October 26th. It expects to release a draft environmental impact statement for the project next fall, and then release it for another round of public comment. Election time is creeping up on us again, and over the next several Inland Journals, we'll look at a variety of candidates and ballot measures in Washington and Idaho. Today, we focus on two of the least sexy offices in Spokane County. We start with the assessor's race, featuring two Republicans, Tom Conis and Leonard Christian. The winner will replace the incumbent assessor, Vicki Horton. Conis is one of her employees. Christian is a realtor who also filled in for a year as a state legislator from the Spokane Valley. Tom Conis started his career in the assessor's office nearly 25 years ago.
My job is to place values on buildings and land that is then based on your tax bill.
And how do you do that?
Depends on the type of property. A lot of the more normal parcels, of course, we use comparable sales and try to then get the value in that range.
Sometimes there are no comparable sales. For example, one of Conis's assignments, the former Kaiser Aluminum Complex in North Spokane. That makes the assessment a little trickier. And when the valuation is made, people who disagree with it sometimes make a trip to the courthouse to give the assessor a piece of their mind. Conis says that's just part of the job, and he defends the role of the assessor's office as a necessary part of the structure of county government. He has served under several assessors, and now, a quarter of a century in, with his latest boss leaving, he's decided it's his turn to give it a try.
I'm not sure that I know why I want to be the head guy, other than I do have the experience and the knowledge in the office. I think the transition will be a smooth one. Right now, the assessor's office is performing at a pretty good level. We rank at the top in just about every statistical category the Department of Revenue, who oversees all the assessor's offices, tracks, and we're doing really well.
He says the assessor's office is a professional office. Its people require formal training, and it's best run by someone who has had that training.
I'm not a politician. I've never wanted to be a politician. And there really is no room for politics in our office. Everybody that comes into our office should be treated the same, no matter what party or whatever they're affiliated with.
Conis's opponent is Leonard Christian. He's also a Republican. He retired from the Air Force and went into real estate sales. He also served a year in the legislature as a replacement for former Spokane Valley Representative Larry Krause. Christian was defeated when he sought to be reelected to that seat. He says others had approached him in the past about running for assessor, but he declined because Horton, a fellow Republican, held the office.
When I found out she had announced she's retiring, it became an open seat. Then I got another phone call, and it's just like, okay, well, let me look at this a little bit more. And then I started going down the list of what they do, and it's just check, check, check. I mean, it's a business position. You know, you're, again, managing the budget, a $3.4 million budget of the taxpayers' money.
Christian thought it was a good fit for him, so he filed to run. He says the people skills he developed as a realtor will allow him to improve the customer service of the assessor's office. Christian is a member of the county's Board of Equalization, which considers tax appeals from property and business owners. He says Spokane County has one of the highest appeals rates in the state. He says that highlights the need for better communications from the assessor's office.
I've been dealing with people's issues, you know, a good portion of my life. And I find that most people just want to be heard. They want to, you know, be able to sit down with you and explain their issue. And hopefully you'll be able to resolve that.
Christian says he supports a full review of the appraisal process to make assessments more frequent and more accurate.
Homes are sold on average across the nation once every 5 years. So why are we not taking that sales price and assigning that the assessed price when it's sold? If it's an arm's length transaction, they had a fee appraisal, they had somebody who's certified and licensed in Washington State go in the home, paid to look inside the home, not just sit out in the front street and take a picture, look in the home, come up with a value of the home. We disregard that value.
Leonard Christian is one of two Republicans running for Spokane County Assessor. He won more than 54% of the vote in the primary to Tom Conis's 42%. And now to the Spokane County Treasurer's race, whose winner will also replace an incumbent. The candidates have two distinctly different backgrounds and fundamentally different views about the role of the treasurer. On the campaign trail this summer, Michael Baumgartner is enjoying looking back at his 8 years as a state senator from Spokane.
I have accomplished a lot of things, from doing the new WSU Medical School to full funding for North South Thruway to the only tuition cut in American history, and it's all been a team effort.
But Baumgartner says he's ready to work closer to home. He has a wife and four children, eight or younger, at home, and he sounds ready for a new professional opportunity. The challenge he has chosen is Spokane County Treasurer.
If we are successful in that process, I'll look forward to fighting tax increases and trying to manage the office well and try to bring people closer to their tax dollars with some transparency initiatives that I want to do. So, you know, again, it's just to continue on in the spirit of public service.
That public service is to do the financial business of the county, which Baumgartner says he embraces. But he says the treasurer can have added value.
You know, the treasurer can also be a very important advocate for policy, because I know personally, because I've worked with them in the Senate.
He says he worked with County Treasurer Rob Chase and Chase's deputy, Spokane Representative Mike Volz, 2 years ago on a bill that related to paying back taxes. Baumgartner's Democratic opponent David Green has a fundamental disagreement with that view.
I don't think it's appropriate for any single county treasurer to express his or her policy positions, because treasurers in Washington State, county treasurers, should speak with one voice.
There's another issue about which they disagree. What are the best qualifications for a treasurer? Green has been a certified public accountant for 35 years. To him, the answer is obvious. Go with the person with the financial chops.
It's a task-focused job. And the 30, 31 people in the treasurer's office focus on collecting and keeping track of real estate taxes, collecting excise taxes when property is sold. They manage and keep track of funds for about 80 other governmental entities. And I decided that it was important to have competence in county government as opposed to somebody with a policy background in this role.
Baumgartner thinks Green's view of the treasurer's job is too narrow, and he says he has financial experience to go along with his policy background.
You know, academically, I studied economics at WSU, have a bachelor's in economics and a minor in mathematics, then went to Mozambique and worked with the Jesuits for a while as a volunteer, and then went to Harvard for my master's degree. At Harvard, I taught economics and enjoyed that process. I do enjoy teaching.
And he points to his time as one of the leaders of the Senate Ways and Means Committee and his role in writing state budgets. So, says David Green, it's left to the people to decide.
The voters in Spokane County should have a choice as to who their treasurer should be, somebody who's got 35-plus years of financial experience or someone who's got little, if any, financial experience and has been historically focused on policy issues.
A majority of voters chose Baumgartner in the August primary. He won 57% of the vote to David Green's 43%. You can find out more about the candidates by going to the Spokane Public Radio website. Click on the Regional News tab and then the 2018 election link. This week, leaders of the Affiliated Tribes of Northwest Indians have been holding their annual fall meeting at the Coeur d'Alene Casino and Hotel in Worley, Idaho. What's different this year is that one of their own is fully immersed in a high-profile campaign for Idaho governor. And so it was only natural for Paulette Jordan to stop by and say a few words.
Ach, es lachlacht. Hello, my good relatives. Hast du squeezed them? Good morning. I'm a little taller than our elder here, Lenny.
Jordan grew up on the Coeur d'Alene Reservation and lives there, even though she's spending much of her time this campaign season traveling.
My staff and I, we very much want to be the best hosts and representatives as possible, but we're in the broad midst of our campaign, and it's been incredible. So I'm really proud to share this experience with all of you.
Jordan says she had just flown in from California. Since she won the Democratic Party's nomination in May, she's been very much in demand as one of the symbols of a growing number of women running for office, especially in the Democratic Party.
her visibility running for an office like governor, as she has stated in her speech, has reached not just a national audience, but an international audience.
That's Muthoni Wambu-Kroll. She's the Vice President of National Outreach and Training at Emily's List. It's an organization that recruits women who are Democrats and pro-choice to run for office. She was in Worley to test the organization's first training program for Indigenous women who are interested in running for office. Her colleague at Emily's List is Vanessa Cardenas.
Since the 2016 election, more than 40,000 women have reached out to us saying they want to run for office. Now, if you compare that to the entire 2016 cycle, which we had a total of 920, so the volume is huge. So the reason why we developed these trainings is to give women some basic tools that they need so they can run for office.
Cardenas advises prospective candidates to do their research about themselves and the offices they seek. And then she and her colleagues teach them about fundraising and how to tell their personal stories. Wambu-Kroll says it helps when women can see that other female candidates are successful.
If you can't see it, how do you know to be it? And we're hearing that over and over and over again in rooms. And so candidacies like Paulette's are absolutely essential. There are women who are showing up absolutely inspired by the fact that she is running.
Jordan's odds of winning in a deep red state like Idaho are long, though a recent poll showed her within single digits of the Republican candidate, Lieutenant Governor Brad Little. So she still has work to do before she can become the Gem State's first female governor. But Paulette Jordan believes the big picture trend for female and Native American candidates is a positive one.
You know, people are supporting us, seeing that there's a powerful Indigenous voice that needs to be represented not only at the state level, but at the federal level. And of course, at the local city council seats, mayors, we have people who are running for county commissioners. So we have to be proud of that because our folks have come a long ways.
Ultimately, Vanessa Cardenas from Emily's List hopes the percentage of women in public office in general matches the percentage of women in the population. We have a long way to go, she says. For nearly a decade, a Washington man has been making his way through British Columbia's court system. He's been trying to reinstate his indigenous rights north of the border. The Canadian government officially declared his tribe extinct more than 60 years ago. Correspondent Emily Schwing was in Vancouver this month for a hearing in a Canadian appellate court.
This is a case about tribal sovereignty, recognition, and reconciliation in Canada. In the eyes of the Canadian government and on paper, the Sinex tribe has been extinct in Canada since 1956. That's when the last surviving member of the tribe there passed away.
I was hunting last week.
Rick Desitel is clearly alive and very much a member of the Sinex tribe.
The day before we came here, he was up there hunting.
So was his wife, Linda, who sometimes hunts with him. The Desitels live on the reservation of the Confederated Tribes of the Colville in Washington State. They were in Vancouver for the hearing of a second appeal in Rick Desitel's long-running illegal hunting case.
We are still here!
Around 40 Sinex descendants drove over 300 miles from the Colville Reservation to Vancouver to support the Desitels. In 2010, Rick was charged with hunting without a permit and as a non-resident in Canada. Despite an acquittal and an overturned appeal, the provincial government in British Columbia is still pursuing charges, now in a higher venue similar to the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. I wasn't allowed to record inside the courtroom during a hearing on this appeal, but here's what Glenn Thompson, British Columbia's prosecuting attorney, told three appeal court justices. Thompson says Rick Desitel simply doesn't have a right to hunt in Canada because he's not Canadian. Thompson doesn't disagree that Desitel is a descendant of Canada's Sinext tribe, but he told the justices that the provincial government believes Sinext, who now live in Washington, are members of a successor tribe. They're American, and so they can't freely hunt on their traditional homeland in Canada. Thompson ran out of time before he could finish his arguments, and appeal court Justice Daphne Smith chided him. There are critical issues here, and we're just flying through them, Smith said from the bench. This is a really important case, she told Thompson.
That just says to me, it's like, you just don't have all your balls in the court, mister.
Linda Desitel has been part of her husband's fight for tribal recognition in Canada for decades. She says Justice Smith's comments to the prosecution stood out.
How she kept saying, this is a very serious situation. This is not just, oh, you know, a couple Indians come up here hunting. This is serious. This is huge.
Then it was defense attorney Mark Underhill's turn to present his arguments. To be Sinaixed, said Underhill, they need to be able to carry out their culture in the place they're from. His point was that regardless of where the international border lies, in order to be Sinaixed, they have to be able to hunt elk within their traditional territory in both the U.S. and Canada. The practice is inherent to their culture, and the Sinaixed are indigenous to the region. In a very real way, Mr. Desitel is more Canadian than all of us put together, Underhill said. He cited historic records that show the Sinaixed have traditionally lived and hunted elk in southern British Columbia for millennia. Then he laughed. My mother is from Wales, he said. And that may sound theatrical, but Mr. Desitel's family has been here for thousands and thousands of years, he told justices. Underhill declined to comment on the hearing, but afterwards he joked with client Rick Desitel about next seeing him in Ottawa.
That's right, yeah. Get that ID up to date.
Because that's where many people believe this case could go, all the way to Canada's Supreme Court, to ultimately decide whether the Sinaixed exist in Canada and if they have rights there. A decision from British Columbia's Court of Appeal is expected in 6 months. In Vancouver, I'm Emily Schwing reporting.
Next week on Inland Journal, we'll continue with stories about people and ballot measures that will appear on the November ballot in Washington and Idaho. Inland Journal is Spokane Public Radio's weekly public affairs program. If you miss us on the radio, you can listen or read our stories online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thank you for listening and for providing your financial support. I'm Doug Nadvornik.